Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll take you beyond the headlines with insight and analysis from leaders and decision makers shaping our future. So whether you're tuning in live or catching up later on the podcast, stay ahead with some of the stories that really count. Coming up on the program today, ignoring South Africa's 1 trillion rand economy at our peril. Why procurement is suddenly having its moment on the global business stage. Who controls so-called AI agents? It's Friday, the 25th of April. Now, it's the trillion rand engine that barely features in economic policy debates. I'm talking about South Africa's informal economy. Often dismissed as marginal or unregulated, it is in fact a thriving, complex marketplace, and it spans spaza shops, taxi routes, fast food outlets, and backroom rentals. Now, there's new data that suggests its true size could in fact exceed a trillion rand. What does that mean? Well, it would be larger than agriculture and mining combined. That is staggering. Yet this vast sector remains poorly understood, often undervalued. So what does it all mean for jobs, growth and economic inclusion? And maybe more importantly, how should government and big business be engaging with it? I want to talk now to Gigi Alcock, founder of Casinomics and also an expert in the informal economy. Gigi, it's nice to talk to you again and thank you very much indeed. I want to start with that headline number, over a trillion rand. How did you arrive, or how has that valuation been derived as far as the informal economy is concerned? As I mentioned, it is an eye-wateringly large amount.
So if we look at those figures, so the number of a trillion rand is an estimate. What I can account for from a range of sources is around about 750 billion. And that comes from different sources. So for argument's sake, the spaza sector, broadly spaza sector, is worth over 180 billion, according to Trade Intelligence, an agency that focuses on that sector. The taxi sector is worth 50 billion rand, according to Transaction Capital. According to the Department of Housing, there's more than a million backroom rentals or amaromi rented out. If you work that out at an average of between 2,000 to 3,000 rand rental per month, you're talking well in excess of 20 billion rand a year. Even the Muti sector, a seemingly tiny sector, the University of Pretoria did some research, I think in 2019, saying that that sector was worth 18 billion rand a year across about 150,000 Muti traders. So there's a bunch of them that accumulates on actual figures that we have access to, that works on 750 billion, and that excludes a huge number of other sectors, including bakeries, caterers, gassy mechanics, and other sectors, which are very large sectors that we don't have numbers for.
And Gigi, we ignore this at our peril, yet I would suggest to you that policymakers and maybe big business or more established formal business don't really grasp the scale and importance of this informal economy.
So this is what I've been saying for years about how important it is, and in fact, in many ways, it's the future of economic activity. I must say that though in the recent number of years, there's a growing number of people who accepting how big it is. Kheri Furi of Capitec, I've done work with the Capitec guys. He recently said that he believed that the next big sector is what they call the emerging economy or this informal economy. And he said at a recent conference that he believed there could be potentially up to 20 million of these businesses that are bankable, that are currently unbanked through any form of business channel. So there's a growing kind of look at the sector. People like Tiger Brands have recently announced that they are focusing on the spaza sector for distribution to grow their business, and so on. So I think the sad thing is that it's not really appreciated in terms of its scale and the nature of that sector. And often it's just looked at in terms of how can we extract value from it and not how can we grow the sector as an economic engine. Because I think the real value of it lies in how we can boost that sector.
Let me pick you up on the Capitec example that you've just given me. How then, in your opinion, should banks and even fintechs be approaching the township market or the informal economy? What should they be doing, and where do you think they might be making their mistakes?
I mean, one of the simple ones is that, you know, there's a tendency to say this is an unbanked business sector, the informal business sector. And I say it is completely banked, but it's personally banked. People use their personal bank account for their business. So the vast proportion of these businesses are using a personal bank account. They're operating from a personal premises, in front of a house, a back room or a salon at the back of a township home and so on. And so what happens is that we tend to separate kind of business and personal, even in things like banking or insurance or other kind of products. And yet people are merging these, in essence, a bit like a gig worker or a home worker, where in essence, you know, you're not distinguishing between those. So products that we provide to people should actually look at this unique kind of home-based, residential-based, or personally-based. And generally, our products are either business or either personal, and they don't take into account how these businesses operate. The other thing is that a lot of the time, it's very expensive. So, for instance, if you have a card acceptance device and you tap on that device to make or you receive payment from that, it takes you 12 to 24 hours to see your money. And so, you know, for a very cash flow reliant business, they can't wait for 12 to 24 hours to get their money to go and restock. And so we would need to look at solutions that answer those specific pain points and problems that these businesses have.
Yet there would also be a sense that maybe this economy is also starting to shift away from cash.
There's a really big move away from cash towards card, as well as I believe I was involved in launching a product called PayShop, which is a instant account-to-account using a mobile platform for payment, which instantly appears in your account without that 12 to 24-hour delay. But what we're seeing is that the vast majority of people, particularly in the lowest economic levels like social grant recipients, pensioners, and so on, have all transitioned from cash receipt of money at pension pay points to a debit card. And this has also driven the desire to pay by these cards. And we're seeing a number of fintechs, if you want, Kazang, Shop2Shop, Ikorka, and others who have devices that normally sold airtime and electricity, bus tickets, and so on through these devices have now added the ability to tap a card. And we've seen a very dramatic shift towards card payment at these informal outlets, whether it's a salon or a tavern or a spaza shop, where people are either tapping to pay for their groceries at a spaza shop or doing what they call cashbacks. Instead of standing at a two-hour queue at an ATM or so on, they are taking a taxi to an ATM. They can walk down to their spaza shop, go to a Kazang or Shop2Shop or Flash device, tap on it and get what they call cash back, so they can withdraw money in walking distance conveniently. So that debit card revolution, as it were, is moving people very rapidly away from cash. And in fact, a recent Reserve Bank study showed that cash is still larger in terms of numeric payments. So it's a small but lots of payments. And actually, debit cards is now the larger portion in value terms of payments. And I think that that's going to accelerate, which also enables the sector, because now they're starting to receive transactions by card or payments by card. They're able to de-risk their business in terms of the issues of cash, but more importantly, have a transaction record that they can use to generate either short-term loans or, you know, whatever financial services they may require.
Let me ask you this question, and I'm trying to get my head around it. If the informal sector is so big, as you've explained to us, and so influential, why would it be overlooked in national economic planning and budget allocation?
I think primarily because, I mean, I get furious all the time at these stats about unemployment that show this high level of unemployment. And my argument is that a pay slip is considered a job. And if you don't have a pay slip and you're earning money informally, as it were, or from your own business, you're considered as unemployed. And we should actually have a different definition of what actually a job is. and it would rewrite what our unemployment figures are. They're substantially lower. But to your question directly, is that because we don't have the data, we don't have these numbers, decision makers, Stats SA, who have their own problems, as we've seen, and others, because they don't have this business case, these stats, they assume it doesn't exist. The business sector, however, is able to recognize that they may not have the stats, but they're seeing this turnover. As an example, the Vugile Property Fund, which has shopping centers in rural areas, townships, and urban areas, recently in their financial results, and they're a listed company, they showed that the growth of trading densities, as in turnover per square meter, at their rural shopping centers was around 7% odd. At their township shopping centers was 14%, and at the urban shopping centers was only 4%. So we just see in that turnover, triple the amount of turnover at a township shopping center than an urban shopping center. And you know, how is that possible if you don't have these incomes and these economies that are there? So I think we're seeing a large number of the business sector, particularly people focused on that space, whether they're shopping center owners like Exemplar and Vugile, or companies like Capitec and Time, or people like ShopRite and Pep, are increasingly refocusing their efforts at the space because they're recognizing and they're seeing it literally in footfall and turnover.
And that's where I am going to leave it. Gigi Alcock, thank you very much indeed. Founder of Kasi Economics, or Kasinomics, a fascinating insight into this 1 trillion rand, possibly more, economy in South Africa. Appreciate your time. Thank you.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, it's often said that procurement and supply chain management is the backbone of any successful organization. And in 2025, that backbone is getting stronger, it's getting smarter and more strategic, thanks in part to the work of CIPS, that's the Chartered Institute of Procurement and Supply. With a global membership of professionals and a mission to drive positive change, the organization is now hosting its Connect and Engage conference and awards. It's a landmark event that aims to elevate the profession, spark innovation, and recognize excellence. And in that respect now, I'm in conversation with Craig O'Flaherty, who's head of CIPS for Business, to talk about the power of procurement, the big themes of this year's event, and why it is potentially a critical moment for the industry. Craig, a very warm welcome, and maybe the big picture first. We talk about procurement having its moment on the global business stage. What does that mean?
Thanks very much, Jeremy. Well, one of the things that you would have seen in the last couple of years is that procurement has definitely changed from being an operational or tactical role or function into being far more of a strategic function. And that was brought about not only by COVID and the Zondo Commission, but obviously more lately by some of the geopolitical risks and the tariffs and things like that. So what you're seeing is that procurement and supply chain professionals are having to transition as well rapidly. They're needing to be innovative. They're needing to be agile. They're needing to actually deliver value far greater than just the cost saving or the purchasing that they were doing previously, but actually adding strategic value to the organization as a collective.
I understand the agility, but how does a procurement manager become more innovative?
One of the ways that procurement executives or professionals can become more agile and innovative is to actually upskill and to develop the technical knowledge that they required from a day-to-day basis. So one of the things that they're able to do is obviously engage with an organization like CIPS or SIPS. We're a global organization, 60,000 members across 150 countries. And we set the standard when it comes to procurement and supply. So we help those public and private sector organizations and individuals to improve their technical skills, improve their leadership, their influencing, their consulting skills, to be able to actually take a seat at the executive table and to be able to contribute far more significantly to the strategic conversations that are taking place within an organization.
And in that respect, the theme this year is connect and engage. What does that really mean, though, in practical day-to-day procurement?
So in practical terms, I think that the biggest thing is to make sure that from a collaboration perspective, professionals are coming together. No single professional or organization has all of the answers. So it's very important for practitioners and professionals from all different industries, all different sectors, geographies, to come together to share global best practice and some of the innovative ideas and solutions that they're implementing, whether that be in the technology space, in the AI space, from a team development perspective, those are all absolutely critical. And coming together at an event like Connect and Engage gives all of our procurement and supply chain professionals across the region that opportunity to learn from other organizations and individuals that have experienced difficulties and have actually succeeded in coming up with solutions for them, and also to try and make sure that they're able to implement that global best practice that we talk of.
I would contend that in the past, procurement has maybe been seen purely as a cost-driven process. You're talking about changing the perception to be more strategic and to be more sustainable, I guess. How difficult is it to turn that ship around?
It's not easy. It is quite difficult for organizations because typically procurement and supply has been a support function for many, many years. But as I mentioned, as a result of COVID, the Zondo Commission, and obviously some of the risks that we're now facing, procurement has transitioned. And a lot of executives, I think if you asked many of the executives from JSE-listed companies and private sector and public sector organizations, if they actually knew who the CPO was 5 years ago, they might actually not have known. But right now, I can guarantee you that they know exactly who the CPO is or who the supply chain manager is. And that individual has been elevated significantly within the organization to actually support the executives to make sure that they make a meaningful contribution.
Not only do they know their name, but where they park their car underground and where their office is as well, I imagine. Craig, what kind of professionals and leaders should be attending this event then? And what do you hope they'll walk away with?
This event is specifically for procurement and supply chain professionals, but it's not exclusively for them because, as I mentioned, if you're an executive in the C-suite, it would be extremely interesting and beneficial for you to attend the Connect and Engage conference to hear a little bit more about what the procurement and supply chain professionals within your organization are having to contend with, some of the things that they're having to look at and take advantage of in order to actually drive that long-term sustainable benefit to the organization.
And can you give us a sneak peek perhaps into one or two of the keynote speakers or sessions that you're particularly excited about?
So when it comes to the speakers, we haven't confirmed the final lineup for the actual conference, so that will be made public in due course. But when it comes to the topics and the discussions, obviously with all of the geopolitical risk, we are looking at resilience. We're looking at risks specifically within our region, also driving trade and sustainability across the African region to make sure that we are not reliant on one market or a particular client or supplier in an instance. But we are also looking at some of the technology and the AI that we have seen in recent years that's making a significant impact globally. So there'll be a lot of sessions, a lot of discussions, panel speakers that are going to be talking and sharing best practice when it comes to technology and AI, not just from a procurement and supply chain perspective, but also warehousing, logistics. So those are some of the topics that will be discussed. And obviously, we are expecting a lot of individuals, not only from the SIPS community, but also individuals that are interested in how procurement and supply could add value to the organization.
And Craig, very quickly, talking about best practice, the awards that at this year's event, I would imagine, will elevate and recognize that impact that you spoke about earlier of professionals in the business.
Absolutely. There will be an awards evening on the second evening, and that is really to showcase some of the fantastic work that procurement and supply chain individuals and organizations have been doing in the last year. So things like risk and resilience, best sustainability project, ethics, best use of technology or AI. Those are just some of the topics or some of the awards that will be presented. We have individual awards as well for top leader, young talent. There's also a new award this year, which is specifically for women in procurement. So She Inspires, and really that's about recognizing the contribution that women are making within procurement and supply as well.
Let us not underestimate the importance of the discipline. That is Craig O'Flaherty. Thank you very much indeed from the Chartered Institute of Procurement and Supply.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, as artificial intelligence becomes the default operating system of modern enterprise, a strange new problem is emerging. AI agents now need managers. What am I talking about? Well, enter the agent in chief. From what I understand, it's a high-level digital overseer coordinating fleets of virtual assistants. But what happens when the machine that books your meetings also decides what deserves your attention? It's an interesting conundrum. Arthur Goldstuck from Worldwide Works is with me, and let's talk a little bit about the rising power and even possible peril of hierarchical artificial intelligence. So let's, Arthur, and welcome to you, start with the core concept. If AI is supposed to simplify work, why are we now creating layers of management for the machines?
Let's go back even a further step into what is an AI agent. And the whole idea is that AI can now be used to conduct a series of jobs, roles, or processes for its user. So, for example, you can set a goal and you can get the AI agent, so to speak, to pursue that goal, make decisions on your behalf, take actions on your behalf to achieve those goals without your intervention. We're obviously not talking about your fitness goals. AI ain't going to help you there, Jeremy.
I am well aware of that, and I've tried.
So have I. So an AI becomes an agent when it has the ability to perceive what's going on around it through the data that you give it and decide on goals around that data, to plan a series of actions to reach those goals and act to achieve those roles. And then it goes without saying, when it's AI, that it has to learn and adapt from what happens. So the idea really is to string together a bunch of tasks so that it seems like you have a virtual assistant. It's not the same as a virtual assistant that answers the phone on your behalf and tries to figure out what the person on the other end is saying and respond accordingly. And that's what you already get in WhatsApp bots and all that sort of thing. So this isn't a bot, but it's a bunch of bots strung together. It's task-driven. So here's the real problem. You're trying to get away from a micromanagement of your software and let your software run itself. That's the agent. But you have a different agent for different purposes. So you have an agent for making appointments, for example. You have an agent for putting an appointment in your calendar. Now, the original agent should be able to do that in the first place. You have an agent for phoning up the restaurant and confirming the number of seats you want at what time and perhaps even what meal, etc., etc. But now what's emerging is the idea that we all are going to have far too many agents, and those companies that are deploying agents are finding that there's actually tremendous complexity in managing all the different agents. So the concept that is now emerged from a company called Salesforce, who are the customer relations leaders in software globally, is the idea of an agent in chief. And that's one agent that will coordinate the activities of all the other agents.
So, Arthur, where then is there a line, if one exists, between the assistance that you've outlined to me and pure manipulation?
It really comes down to the choices that you make. You want to be able to tell the AI what to do, and you want the AI to do the drudge work that you don't want to get involved with. So it's not really a question of the agent taking over from you or the agent making decisions on your behalf that you're not aware of. It's limited very strictly by the parameters that you set for it. So one of the great examples is a tool developed by Google and Harvard Medical School with Stanford Medicine called CoScientist. And the idea was to support researchers working on a treatment for diseases like Alzheimer's. And essentially, there are thousands of agents being coordinated under CoScientist. And I was at the Google Cloud Conference 2 weeks ago in Las Vegas, where they were telling me about what co-scientists can do. And it was astonishing. They described it as each agent taking one problem statement that's a small fraction of the whole Alzheimer's equation. For example, designing a drug for Alzheimer's. and coming up with a possible solution. But then dozens of other agents are doing exactly the same thing. And the agent in chief has got the job of almost a jury that decides which are the best solutions or which are the ones that should be combined in the final solution set, for example. And that coordinates huge amounts of data, huge amounts of decision making, and then presents the scientists themselves, the real scientists, with a set of solutions that they can then debate and choose how to take further. So it's certainly not replacing them. It's making them far more effective.
But Arthur, it does come surely with a degree of risk if the so-called digital chief of staff has access to operational and personal data. Surely you've got to be very judicious about what information is allowed to be used.
It's very risky if you allow the agent in chief to do your whole job for you from a decision point of view, as well as from an ethics point of view. So you've got to oversee it. And it's something that I always say about AI. Any company deploying any AI solutions have to do it with human oversight. The moment they allow the AI to do its own thing, you risk tremendous corporate and business damage. So oversight is key, and deciding where the agent can go off on its own and where it has to be guided by or report to a human being is critical.
So how do you go about setting up that internal oversight then? For instance, could you have an AI governance department within an organization now, or does that fall within the risk within the risk model?
You certainly are going to have more and more chief data officers, as they call them, and probably chief AI officers or heads of AI. You already have those kind of jobs in numerous kinds of businesses. But along with that, you also have an existing system of permissions and hierarchies in the organization. And the agent in chief has to be linked into that hierarchy and has to be grounded in that hierarchy. So the way a Salesforce person put it to me, one of their vice presidents, in fact, responsible for this area of research, said that it's going to be grounded in a lot of personal information, and that ranges from the way you operate to biometric data. So it raises massive issues around security, and that then places a far greater responsibility on the organization and the people deploying these agents to ensure that security is paramount.
And just quickly then, Arthur, in conclusion, as someone who's deeply immersed in this discipline, do you welcome a move like this, or are you worried about it?
I very much welcome it. I'm worried that these companies that put out AI agents are a little too relaxed about how easy it's going to be for the ordinary human being. But I just had a demonstration from a local operation or the local office of a Dutch company called CM.com, which has released an AI platform that is going to simplify the process. And they gave me a demo of it. And it's a lot simpler than when you had to code everything, but you still have to know what you're doing.
Arthur Goldstuck from Worldwide Works, the research company, thank you very much indeed. What a fascinating glimpse. I was going to say into the future, but it actually isn't the future. It's with us right now. Always appreciate your time. And that's where we're going to leave it. That is MoneyWeb at midday for today and for the week. Join us again on Tuesday for more insights shaping the country and the future. Have a successful and safe long weekend. Goodbye, and thank you for listening.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.